I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today we are joined by Sean Martin of the PGA Tour. Sean is on the grounds of the PGA Championship, but the main focus of this podcast is going to be on the upcoming USAM and the Walker Cup team that will be selected right after the USAM. So we're going to diverge and go into a little bit of amateur golf here on the pod, but Spartan, what's happening out in Quail Hollow?
It's raining, as if it had to be like any more of Rory's championship. It's raining right now. It's supposed to rain most of the day. So it's going to be long. It's going to be soft. And, I mean, if Rory wasn't already the favorite, I think the odds are just continuing to move in his favor.
Yeah, it seems like everything's kind of aligning for Rory. The way he played last week, the way he hit the ball, and then combine that with a very soft golf course that he's dominated at, it seems like a tailor-made place for him to break out of his major slump.
I think so. I mean, you hate to say it because winning is so hard, and over 72 holes, there's so many little things that can go your way or go against you, and it's just, I think winning sometimes is overrated as a way to rate players, but I think if Rory leaves you with anything but a win, I feel like you'd have to be disappointed, so... it's Rory and Spieth this week, and I think that's really all the focus of the storyline heading in. And, of course, the shorts. All the talk so far, it's only Tuesday morning, but shorts, for some reason, have been all the rage and all the talk. And I don't know, I just don't quite get it. I think, guys, I like pants. I'm not a huge – I don't think anyone doesn't play golf because pros wear pants. There's some guys like Rory and Ricky look good in shorts, but – at the same time, I don't know. I just think this whole shorts thing has gotten a lot of control.
You know, it always amazes me how golf has these little things that get blown completely out of proportion. I feel like it's unlike any other sport where the smallest little things get, like, the most polarizing views. And shorts this week seems to be the thing. Like, at Aaron Hills, it was the overspray and the fescue. And here we have the shorts that everybody's freaking out about. Like, what's the big deal? It's 92 degrees and humid.
I think people just like, golf is fairly repetitive. So people like something new. I always say novelty is a heck of a drug. And so I think, we've been wearing pants forever. So I get it. Shorts are new. But I don't think, it's viewed like some grow the game initiative. And I work for the pants lobby. We're all pants, so I get it. I'm wearing pants right now, even though the players aren't. But I don't think anyone is going to start playing golf because the guys wear shorts. And on the other side, I don't think anyone doesn't play golf because the pros wear pants. So I don't know. It's good the guys are wearing shorts. I'm kind of glad they go back to pants once the tournament starts. There's just some guys you don't want to see in shorts, frankly, and I think they would even admit it. And so I don't know. I think it makes golf look bad because we're so obsessed with shorts. I think people are like, look, who cares? Just do one or the other and move on with it.
Yeah. I just hope that the maybe we could end the epidemic of you see these kids in these amateur tournaments and it's 95 degrees and they're wearing pants. And you're like, why are you wearing pants at a 36-hole USAM qualifier when it's 90 degrees and you have to walk 36 holes? Like, not one professional would be wearing pants in that situation.
Well, I think it was Justin Thomas, and I think some other guys. I'm pretty sure Justin, if you look at all his old junior golf photos, he's wearing pants because his dad told him that PGA Tour players wear pants, and so he wanted to start preparing for the PGA Tour as soon as possible. But it's like, if we switch to shorts, all those hot summer days in Kentucky when he was wearing pants, those are all out the door, and those were for nothing, I guess. But, I mean, I understand. I kind of appreciate it that a guy – Brian's wearing pants to emulate tour pros. Though I do think at times, take advantage of the rules, use them in your favor and wear some shorts. But I don't know. I like that Justin Thomas had the foresight when he was 7 years old to, like, hey, tour pros wear pants. I'm going to play on tour. I'm going to wear pants when I'm 7 years old.
Hey, I'm out on pants and AM events. Western AM requires the pants, which I think is kind of stupid, but the voluntary pants wearing, like, I saw this one guy at my USAM qualifier who legitimately, like, you could tell he was trying to look like Dustin Johnson, like decked out in full Dustin Johnson gear, and he shot like 92. And you're like, why don't you worry more about your golf game and less about looking like Dustin Johnson?
Yeah, the more you bring it in a fashion sense, the more pressure you're putting on yourself. I'd rather kind of look bad and play good than look good and play bad. The Western AM wearing pants, that's amazing to me. That's three straight 36 hole days in Chicago in July or August wearing pants. And so that is a true endurance test.
Yeah, and they allow shorts now in the practice round, which is, you know, they've opened that up to shorts, but they still require the championship to be in pants. So, I think it's something that they are moving towards, but they haven't gotten all the way there yet.
Maybe that's why the PGA allowed shorts. They saw the Western AM was doing it, and so they thought, you know what, let's get on board too.
Who would think that the Western Golf Association is a trendsetter?
I just love the fact I'm going to the BMW here soon. I love the fact that the Western Golf Association is called that because back when it was formed so long ago, that was the West. Like, yeah. The Western Golf Association goes back so far that Chicago was the Western United States.
With this whole PGA move, it's kind of interesting because with it moving to May, it shines a light on all of the kind of West Coast and Southern courses, which for the most part were developed way after those of like the Midwest. So like Chicago, the Northeast, Philly, New York, and Boston. And you're going to have a lot of newer golf courses that don't have necessarily the championship history of the courses in those, you know, great golf cities, which, you know, and that's a point of the Western Golf Association being the West side of golf.
Yeah, I think I was talking this morning about some places, and I mean, there's so many things logistically and even lengthwise, the reasons you can't do it, but it'd be awesome if the PGA just went off the rails and just take all of these new, you know, link style courses, like go to Pacific Dunes, which I know you can't because I think it tips out at 600 yards. But, you know, go to like Bandon and go to, losing sight, but you know, go to Sand Valley, which might be hard in Wisconsin, May, but go to those kinds of courses and just be known as the place where, you know, all the new, just kind of eccentric courses, we're going to play at those and we're going to get on some really crazy layouts. I think that would be a cool identity for the PGA.
Yeah, you could do Trinity Forest down in Texas. Blue Jack would be an interesting one.
Yeah.
I think Blue Jack could be a really good host. I really liked it when I played there in the fall. I wouldn't be surprised to see Shawl Creek get another one. You know, they set record attendance numbers when they had it there in the 90s, and they just finished up a renovation there. So I would be very I wouldn't be surprised if we saw one going back to Alabama. But
Stream Song, maybe?
Stream Song could be cool. It'd probably be getting into the very hot stage there. And that place is, you know, because it's a phosphate farm, it's like 10 degrees warmer.
Right. I do think Blue Jack would be awesome. Blue Jack's out there, so you have so much land available. I love Blue Jack. I played there once. I'm a big Blue Jack fan. Just the whole vibe, too. But that's a whole different podcast.
Yeah, I like Blue Jack for... I just think... I found it to be very challenging, like subtly challenging. I know the whole identity is playability, but what Tiger did with lies and the way the greens are really receptive for like the low running shot that, you know, a higher handicap and like a senior or junior or a lady would play. But they make it, they're really tough shots for like the person that's flying the ball in there.
Yeah, I think it's a great example of just that whole, you know, challenging for the good player, playable for the not as good player. It's obviously very wide. And I think that you're totally spot on. And there's so many false fronts and just fall offs that you have to think, and you have to think about your misses. And you're, I mean, it is, it's your course. It's width and angles. You got to come in from the right angles to have a chance, but you have the width that it's playable for everyone.
So, you know, another place that's about width and angles that could be a PGA site is this year's USAM site, Riviera. So talking about Riviera on the tour, you see typically older winners come from Riv. I think in the last 12 years, the youngest winner was Charles Howell at age 28. We see this older kind of winner, and it's less about power. You know, power obviously helps, but it's more about hitting it to the proper side of fairways to open up angles to the pins that are really well protected. What do you see maybe experience, so your older college players having an advantage, and then, you know, possibly mid-ams having an advantage at Riv?
I can see that. I'm curious, unfortunately, in the mid-am front, I saw Stuart Hagestad tweet his clubs got stolen, so that doesn't help things, though. I'm sure he's going full force on getting a new set and getting dialed in. But Riv's interesting because I think you do get the older winners. You pointed that stat out to me before, and I didn't realize it until you did. But there is, depending on how the Kikuyu is, there is width in the alleyways, I feel like. But if the Kikuyu is unplayable, obviously then the fairways can be narrow. But I think for the Genesis Open, they've had it where the Kikuyu is a little more playable. And so there's alleyways. You have a lot of playable area then if the Kikuyu is down. And it's brutal when the Kikuyu is up. I think, you know, the NCAA Championship, when Thomas Peters won, I think he was 4 under for 3 rounds, and I think there were like 3 guys under par. So you can definitely play a lot harder than maybe we see it sometimes in February when it's wet. But, you know, you've seen Dustin and Bubba play so well there that I think that you can still bomb it around there depending on how the setup is, and definitely length helps. I think older college players, I could definitely see an advantage, but I don't know. There's just so many guys that just kill it. You can almost play thoughtless golf nowadays, and, you know, hopefully Riviera does force you to think your way around a little bit more than other places have. I haven't lived in Southern California in a while, but I think that it can play a little firmer and faster in August, so that will definitely help experience and bring that to the forefront, because Riviera is designed to obviously play firmer and fast, and it's so tricky. So if they've had good weather, which I haven't looked at the forecast, I think you're spot on there.
Yeah, it's interesting. I spent the week at the Western Am last week, and something that you'd brought up about this, like, thoughtless golf is, I mean, this young revolution that we are seeing on tour, after watching these kids play around Skokie, I think it's, you're only going to see a younger and younger tour for the time being until something happens with technology. I mean, these kids just have no fear. They've never hit a shot that really curves offline. And the ball just goes so straight now that it's just, you know, if there's no wind, and it's these kids are just going to tear up any golf course. I just found it absolutely, these kids are so good at golf now. We're just going to see a tour that gets younger and younger, and we might see an amateur win a tour event in the next 5 years.
I could totally see that. And I think, you know, when I'm 34, and I remember when the Great Big Bertha came out, and that was obviously revolutionary and groundbreaking. And titanium drivers were switching to titanium drivers. It was a new thing. And now you've got guys who've grown up, obviously, with the 460cc heads. And I think, too, really, with how far the ball goes and how far people hit it, you really only need to master, I'd say, 2 skill sets, maybe 3. You have to become a great driver of the golf ball. And then all you're going to have left in from there is wedge. So become a great driver and a great wedge player. You know, you might need your mid-irons for second shots on par 5s and for some par 3s, but really it's driving and wedging now. And so I think it allows you to really focus on those two areas, get really good at those, and, you know, maybe kind of take some other parts of the game out of it, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's definitely changing. I mean, I played our State Am a couple weeks ago, and I don't think I hit more than like I hit a 5-iron on a par 3, but that's the longest iron I hit all week. And it's crazy. It's like, you know, I seem to gain 20 yards. I think I gained 10 yards of distance this year. And it's like you watch these kids. You got Cameron Champ out there hitting 370-yard drives with regularity, and he'd be the longest player on the PGA Tour right now, and he's a 21-year-old kid.
Yeah, and he is. I mean, I think that sometimes people attribute too much of it to athleticism, but I think that also sometimes people overlook it too. I mean, he is an athletic build, athletic kid. You know, like Finau is a very athletic kid. He's very springy. You can just see how he moves. Same with Dustin, obviously. But it's interesting too with TrackMan. I think this all goes back to the ball, but with TrackMan, people make swing changes now based on getting the best TrackMan numbers. So guys are. Whereas before you kind of grew up, I don't know, when I grew up, you tailored your swing basically on hitting the ball straight. You wanted to hit it far enough, obviously, but you were more worried about keeping it in play. Now it's almost like guys tailor their swing to just getting the best TrackMan numbers and hitting it the farthest. I think that is a big change as well.
Yeah, I think you're able to optimize your equipment to such a fine level with TrackMan, and then you're able to optimize your swing to launch at a perfect angle that you've got this. I mean, I think that's one of the underrated things about what technology done is how the golf swings change. I mean, the philosophy of the golf swing is so much different now than it was 15 years ago.
Oh, yeah. I think you see a lot of more bowed left wrists, I think. They let people come in with a shallower angle of attack and maybe kind of hit up and from the inside kind of hit that draw. I think Rory, almost figured that out on his own. Obviously, he was pre-TrackMan when he did, but I think that's why you see a lot more bowed left wrist and really the cup. I think the cup left wrist is just a little phase. But if you want to just kill the ball, that's why I think you'll see a lot more bowed left wrist at the top of swings than before.
Yeah, and the lower body. I mean, these guys use their lower body so much more, and I think that's part of having less big misses, you know? But
yeah.
It's really interesting. You watch these kids, and you're just... I think back, and I'm seeing some kids that are 16, 15-year-olds that are playing in this Western Am, and I think about what my golf game was like when I was 15 and 16 using Tommy Armour Silver Scots, and I'm like, well, this is a completely different game now.
Yeah, I think Scott Fossa had a great point on your podcast before of really the really, really good players, they figured this stuff out on their own. Like, you see how, you know, guys figured out how to use their lower body before we knew about ground forces, and guys knew how to manage the course just because they had golf smarts. But now with data, guys like Scott Fawcett and guys who are good with TrackMan, they can package that data and give it to anyone. So the advantage is almost gone that the kind of wise player had before. They figured it out on their own. Now we have so much data and so much intelligence and so much knowledge that everyone, if you use the right resources, can become an intelligent player. And so I think that's kind of interesting, and it's hard because it takes away the advantage of the guys who really figured it out on their own, because now everyone can kind of figure it out if you go to the right places.
Yeah, it's TrackLine is another big thing, the green reading books.
Yeah.
You saw kids out there, they'd have their TrackLine book out for 18-inch putts, and they'd be layering TrackLine with Aimpoint. I mean, it was crazy. I should have taken a video and, you know, sent it over to Shackelford. He would have really loved to see this, like, this green reading book, Aimpoint, and pretty much the skill of reading greens is gone.
Yeah. I think, it's amazing. It's kind of, I don't know what you do. I don't know where you gain an advantage if you're a smarter player. I don't know what the next frontier really is, because we've got, you know, Fawcett and those people have figured out course management, and they can package and sell it to you. Green reading is gone. Strategy has been figured out through data. I don't know what the next step is for really the wise golfer. In a sense, having that good golfing brain. I mean, that was one of Tiger's huge advantages, his golfing brain, obviously besides all the physical talent. And I mean, Jack Nicklaus as well. So I don't know what's next, honestly. I don't know where people differentiate themselves mentally, I guess.
Maybe it's about getting woke to width and angles. It's all architecture.
Yeah. I think, you know, that could be it. I mean, I think, obviously, there's such a big emphasis on hitting it far and bombing it. And for good reason, and Brody's data has backed that up. But I do think that people now start to ignore strategy in a sense. because they just figure, well, everyone tells me to just go mash it as far as I can. So I think we could come back full circle where now guys who can strategize well will have an advantage because people maybe are asleep at the wheel a little bit. I could see that.
Mm-hmm. So to get back, you know, we've now divulged into this technology and modern game talk, but to get back into the amateur golf scene, from your time covering college and AM golf extensively at Golf Week, what were a couple of your favorite amateur events?
I always loved the USAM. That's an obvious answer, but I think for a different reason than it was the USAM, that just that it was the biggest, but it's always held on great golf courses, and I always loved, you can walk down the middle of the fairway of a course, and so you can watch from the middle of the fairway a course being played properly, if you will, or at least played by very skilled players. And I thought that was really cool, and that was one of my favorite things about amateur golf and going to amateur events, and I always recommend telling people to do it if they can, if you have amateurs in town, or if you live in Chicago and they got the Western amateurs, that you can walk in the fairway with a small crowd on a really great golf course and watch someone play it, you know, from a high skill level. And so I think that's the best part of amateur golf. But same thing with NCAAs. I think the match play format, I think is great. Obviously, it's been accepted very well. But there honestly was so much drama when you were on site that it was awesome. So I think NCAAs, for that reason, I think then U.S. Amateur, just because of the great venues and then obviously the stakes are so high, were some of my favorites. The Western's good, too. I think I like the 36 whole days. You can really, if you want to, you can walk a ton and see a ton, which was always obviously great.
Yeah, it this year's field over there was pretty insanely good too. I really like amateur golf. I think it's a really cool way to get to see a lot of the future, you know, PGA Tour players. People were talking last week at the Western AM, how many PGA Tour winners are going to be from this field, and I think the general consensus was probably five. But I think that's something you sent me a text. A couple of weeks ago, we were talking about sponsors exemptions and it's just talking about how, you know, you see all these kids that are great college players, great amateur players, and how you always expect them to make it. But then, you know, a lot of them don't because it's just so hard to get to the PGA Tour level.
It's so hard. And I think one of the great skills is being able to play well when you need to. And obviously there's some things that happen that you can't control. There's injuries, or sometimes your game goes south just that summer that you're turning pro. But there's something, a skill of, like, guys are able to rise when they need to, and you've seen it with, you know, what Steve did in earning his card without status, and Rom did it. And, you know, I think when you have such limited opportunities like you do when you first turn pro, I think you need to be able to play well in the widest variety of variables, if you will. So, you know, some guys, they can thrive on amateur setups that might be a little bit, maybe just a little bit shorter than tour courses, though really a lot of the amateur and NCAA setups are more and more starting to mimic tour setups, which I think is why guys make the turn so quickly and kind of get on tour so quickly. But, you know, if you're not a good wind player, or you're not, you know, good on a certain type of golf course or a certain type of weather, and you only have 6 or 7 starts to make it and try to get your card or try to get to the web finals, like, you have to learn to handle those. You can't just, you know, have a bad tournament like college where, okay, my score gets thrown out, it's not a big deal. It's like, hey, you got to learn to figure it out and learn to be able to play well in these different conditions. And so I think the guys that really make it very quickly are the guys who can play well in the widest variety of conditions and courses and that kind of stuff, because they only have 6 or 7 shots to try to get their card. And so, you know, you have to just get it done even if the course doesn't fit you.
I think one of the underrated things just about professional golf that people discount is the whole idea of going from this controlled college environment to out on your own, on the road, alone, no friends. Like, when you're on the road with your college team, you've got your best friends, you've got your coach who's taking care of everything, and then all of a sudden you're just thrown into the deep end. And, you know, whether you're up on the Canadian Tour or you're down in Latin America or you're doing Monday qualifying on the web, like, that is a huge life change. And being able to handle that at 23, 24 years old, 22 years old is not easy.
Yeah, I think I was listening to a podcast David Axelrod had Theo Epstein on, the GM of the Cubs, and he said that they looked so much at kind of players' makeups and how they handle pressure, because so many guys, that fit, the hard transition is you go from being the big fish in the little pond. You know, you're the star, the media's covering you, everyone's throwing equipment and attention at you because you're one of the best amateurs in the world, to now you're a little fish in a big pond. And some guys, I think, you know, now you go, no one really gives a rip about you. You're, you know, last tee time off of the day, you're, you know, no one cares. You're, and that's a big adjustment for some guys. And I think some guys, their egos take a hit and they can't handle it. And I think too, kind of like what you talked about, there's so much more pressure. Like if you're at a college event, you know, you're 25th going in the last round, if you shoot 66, you know, that might help the team. You finish 10th, but if you shoot 75, it's not as big a deal. Whereas now, like, every round really, really matters. And so if you're a new guy playing tour on a sponsor exemption and you're in 18th place, going into Sunday, like, that's a lot of pressure. And so every shot counts that much more. Every round counts that much more. Every round means something about getting, you know, your points for the Web.com Tour Finals or getting your tour card that way. Or, I don't know, every shot just means so much more that you're playing under so much more pressure that I think some guys struggle handling that.
Yeah, you see that with the Web.com so much, too, is, like, one shot is the difference between 22nd and getting another start. Say you don't have full status, and one shot then drops you to like 40th because they're so bunched together and there's so much talent down there. And the differentiation is a lot of times is just having your bad round be a 71 versus a 73 is the huge difference, because almost every tournament you're going to have one bad round. And it, the guys that can have their bad rounds, and I think this is what is so great about Spieth, is his bad, he plays horrible and shoots 69 somehow.
Yeah, and that was Tiger's skill too. And I think when guys get out from college, I don't think they're used to feeling final round pressure when they start the final round at 33rd place or whatever. I think that's kind of new to them. Whereas on the web, that's a huge thing because you've got to move up 8 spots to get a start for next week.
Yeah, it's interesting. So speaking of, you know, pressure and playing well at the right time, the Walker Cup team selection is going to be made right after the USAM, and this has got to be, you know, one of the years where there's more great players and more kind of unknown who's going to get these last spots for Spider Miller. I don't envy the position he's in, because there's probably about 20 guys that you could make a case deserve to be on this team.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that gets thrown in the mix is, you know, if a total unknown wins the U.S. Amateur, he's from the U.S., he takes the spot, as he should, but that mixes things up too. And it's interesting, this is the first year that they're going to name the whole team after the U.S. Amateur, which I'm sure some guys, you know, they have a good sense they'll be on the team, but you almost have to feel like that's a good way to go, just because there's so much, like you said, it's so tightly packed that it's hard to maybe pick yourself, you know, have 5 or 6 guys pitched by this time already, like they usually would have. So I don't know. I don't think that change was received the best by some people. I know I saw some articles against it because guys are just kind of in the dark all summer, and I get it. But at the same time, you kind of need some flexibility because of how tightly packed the race with stock is.
Yeah, and, you know, there is this aspect of the Walker Cup where it's, you have to be a USGA guy to get the spot. They value, it's not all about merit of play, which you can say it's right or wrong, but there is something about the USGA where you had, you know, perfect example is John Peterson, you know, the Walker Cup year wins the Jones Cup, which is one of the biggest amateur events, and the NCAAs, and doesn't get a spot because of his personality.
And was second in a Web.com event.
Yes. So you've got this kid that by playing merit was probably the best amateur player in the country and didn't get a spot. So that is a little bit interesting of a, and you probably see the same thing with the Ryder Cup and captain's picks, where, you know, they don't necessarily take the best guy, they take the right guy for the team. And this year, so looking at it, you know, I think there are 4 clear locks and maybe 5, depending on how you break it down. I've got in there Stuart Hagestad, who's the reigning U.S. Mid-Am champ, member at L.A. Country Club, and then also was the low am at the Masters, qualified for the U.S. Open, and he'll be playing the U.S. am this week. But I think he's a guarantee because of that mid. You know, they want to keep a mid am spot, and he's been one of the more impressive players, regardless of age, in amateur golf. Then you got Cameron Champ, who people will recognize that name from the U.S. Open, but he's also been on a tear. He won the Trans Miss and finished runner-up at the Pacific Coast Am. Got to the semifinals of the Western Am last week. I think he's a lock. Mav McNealy, I think just for pedigree, he was longtime world number one player. He's in there. He's made the cut in his last two starts on the PGA Tour. And then you've got Braden Thornberry, who NCAA champ, and then he also won the Jones Cup, and he won the Sonny Hanna a couple weeks ago. So, yeah, I mean, and then you've got the T4th at FedEx St. Jude. So that could, he's got to be in there. Do you have anybody else that you would consider locks?
I think if by lock, I mean, I'd be shocked if they weren't picked. I think you've got to put Colin Morikawa in there. Mm-hmm. It's maybe a name that people aren't quite as familiar with because he hasn't, you know, played a tour or hasn't played a PGA Tour event. He hasn't, you know, really played a major. And so I think that it's a name that people outside of the amateur and college aren't familiar with. But last year he loses a playoff to Ollie Schneider-Jans in a Web.com Tour event. He wins the Sonny Hanna last year. He loses the playoff to Braden Thornberry this year. And then he wins the Northeast, which is about as high as they get in amateur events, up there in the upper echelon. First team All-American at Cal, was second at the Trans Mid. So I think Morikawa, I think he's got to be on there. I'd be completely shocked if he wasn't.
Yeah, I was having a discussion with somebody last week, and he might be the best amateur player in the game right now. I think he's number one in the scratch players rankings, which, you know, we could probably talk for an hour about the different amateur rankings and what's the best one. But I think that one of the things that's most overlooked is that kid, what he did in the Web.com event last year. I mean, that is unbelievable to lose in a playoff at the Web.com level. And I mean, he lost to a very, very good player in Ollie Schneider-Jans.
Yeah. And I think it was a final round 64. It was a pretty impressive final round to get into the playoffs. So I think I think you're right. I think that, you know, we often rate our amateurs by how well we know them based on what they've done in, you know, televised events, U.S. Open, NCAA champion, you know, Masters, that kind of stuff. But Morikawa hasn't done anything really there, per se. The web event was not on television, I don't believe. And so I think that he's one of those guys who hardcore fans will know, but I think more people need to know about him.
Yeah. So then, you know, so that gets us to five players in get for sure if we put Morikawa in. And the Walker Cup, unlike the Ryder Cup, is only 10 spots, so a little bit less. I mean, if it was 12, I feel like it would help out Spider Miller so much, because here's where it gets kind of crazy is you've got guys like Sam Burns, who just finished top 10 at the Barbasol, and, you know, won five, I think, times in the NCAA season. You've got, and I think Sam Burns is turning pro after the Walker Cup. You've got Scottie Scheffler, who is a former U.S. Junior champion and then also was the low am at the U.S. Open. So that's a Scheffler's a good example of a USGA guy, wouldn't you say?
I think so. I think one of the things, or a couple of things always help with guys trying to make this team. The USGA, I think, they always favor a lot their past champions. So Scottie Scheffler won the junior, and that was years ago, but I think they like to have some of their past champions on the team. And then also being on other USGA teams, which there's not that many of them, but, you know, Scheffler and Brad Dahlke, along with Matt McNealy, played in the World Amateur Team last year, and I think that definitely helps your candidacy. I think there are, as you kind of said, USGA guys, and I think a big part of that is winning USGA events or playing on USGA teams. I think it definitely helps both their candidacies.
Yeah, and I mean, Scheffler is a guy that is, it's hard to ignore what he's done. I mean, he almost won the NCAAs. You know, you don't always see the consistency out of him, but he always seems to be around in big events. You know, I think he made the cut in the other U.S. Open he played in, and you know, he's a big time player.
Yeah, I think low aim at the U.S. Open means a lot. So I think I think he's got to be a lock. I think I'd almost throw him into that category. I'd be shocked if he was not on that team.
Mm-hmm. So that, you know, and Burns is, I don't think you can really ignore Burns either. I mean, he was arguably the best player in college golf last year.
Played in the U.S. Open at Oakmont. Played very well at the Barbasol, I think finished sixth.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's been a little bit more quiet on the amateur front, but his college play was so strong. And then I think finishing sixth, even if it is a PGA Tour event that's played opposite the Open Championship, I still think, I mean, that can't be ignored.
So if you put those two guys on, you're up to seven spots, and then
I know we're already filling up fast.
Exactly, but then you go down into this. You know, an interesting one is Dylan Meyer. Unbelievable college season, and then last year in the summer he won the Western Am, made a deep run at the US Am, and you've got him sitting here, but he hasn't been, his form of late hasn't been that good since, you know, he had this. This stomach issue, and you know, he had to be hospitalized during the college season. And since he hasn't gotten back to that form that we saw last summer or during the college season. What do you do with a guy like that?
I think it's a tough one. It kind of reminds me of Scott Langley a little bit. In 2010, Langley finished 16th at the U.S. Open at Pebble, made the quarters of the USA and the Chambers, and played on that World Amateur team. I think Meyer was the first alternate for last year's World Amateur team. Langley, the next year, he lost the game and started playing pretty poorly, and he didn't get picked for that walk-up team. And really, at the start of 2011, he was probably, you know, top three among favorites for that team. And I think, unfortunately, Dylan reminds me a little bit of that case. It's just, I think that, you know, last year's results can only carry you so much, and I think that he's going to have to do a lot at the U.S. Amateur to get on that team. I think almost I'd say Nick Hardy, his teammate, has a better chance right now of getting on that Walker Cup team.
Yep, Hardy is an interesting one too. He's right on the bubble. He hasn't had any big wins, but if you look at all the big events, you see him in the top five, top ten every single time. So the consistency's there, and I think he's a guy that is a big team guy in terms of. You know, a guy that people want on their team. It'll be interesting to see what happens with Hardy.
That one kind of reminds me of Blaine Barber in 2011. Blaine didn't really have a big win to really hang his hat on, but just very consistent. Mm-hmm. And a guy who, again, a big team guy, was popular with his teammates. And so, you know, we always rate these amateurs, I think, by their big win. What's their big win? We can define them as NCAA champion or U.S. amateur champion or whatever. So I think guys who are consistent get overlooked because of that. But I think, you know, Hardy made the cut at Chambers Bay and played pretty well. Made the cut at the John Deere over the summer and then had a good showing at the Western. And so I think Hardy is kind of like that. He's, you know, not the big win, but very consistent and just a strong player who I think gets overlooked a little bit.
I really think Hardy's game translates well to the next level. Also, when I look at these guys and who I see succeeding and making it to the PGA Tour. I think Hardy is a guy. He's such a good stroke play player, and with the PGA Tour, Web Tour, I mean, there's only one non-stroke play event. I think he's a guy that translates so well to the next level. You know, the one thing, he doesn't have the greatest match play record. If you're looking at the smallest things to differentiate these guys. Another crazy thing is that Illinois, so I'm obviously a Chicago native, you know, we've had seven Walker Cuppers ever from Illinois, and this year we could have two between Nick Hardy and then Doug Gim, who plays at Texas. Doug, he won the Pacific Coast Am, and he's a real steady player. He's number seven in the Wagger rankings, and then in the Scratch Players rankings, he's four. He's a guy that you kind of almost put in this lock category.
I think so. I mean, I think we're almost up to like seven or eight locks. And really, you know, again, if you throw in a random USAM chance, there's like one or two places for wiggle room, which is funny because I think there's about six guys we'll be able to mention pretty soon here who are going to be on that bubble.
Mm-hmm.
So, Yeah. I don't know. It's going to be the finest hair. It's going to be kind of the separator for who gets those final couple spots.
Yeah, I mean, you go down a little bit further and you see Sean Crocker, who he won the Porter Cup last year, was a star at UCLA, but you know, recently he got into contention on the European Tour. You've got Dawson Armstrong, who is the 2015 Western Am champ. I think he kind of has an interesting case because he gets slighted by playing at Lipscomb, a smaller school, and he doesn't have necessarily the level of competition that can help him in these world rankings, but he ends up finishing really high. You've got Brad Dahlke, who's the star at Oklahoma. He had a really rough stretch, but seemingly is back to top form. Scott Harvey, another mid-am. I just unless he makes like a very deep run at the USAM, I don't think he has a chance. Norman Zhang, who was the Western Am, who swept the medalist and the match play of the Western Am. Derek Bard, who made a deep run and former USAM finalist. John Oda, Jimmy Stanger. Who do you like of this group getting a spot?
I think a lot of it is going to come down to the USAM. Kind of like I remember back in 09, Uline, a big part of what got him on the team was making the quarters. He had a bad college season, gets the quarters at Southern Hills and gets put on the team because of that USAM performance kind of put him over the top. And so I think so much is going to come down to USAM. And you're going to have matches that kind of are between hopeful guys. I think as a West Coast guy, I think Oda doesn't get enough credit. Oda Monday qualified for the Sony also this year. And I'm always intrigued. I think Sahith Tagala is a guy who has an interesting resume. I don't think he's done enough to get on the team per se, but you know, he could make a run at Riviera. I think Pepperdine does play there a little bit, and he shot 67 in the first round, Northern Trust this year. But I think Dahlke showed the squad, or showed the selection committee, what they needed to see. Finished second in medal play at the Western Am. I think Norman Zhang deserves to be on the team, but he might have just come on too late. He's so young and so kind of new to the amateur scene. I mean, he was supposed to be in the second semester of his senior year of high school this past spring, but he came out early, played at Oregon, was freshman of the year in half a year. So I think skill-wise, I think Zhang deserves maybe more of a look than, you know, he might be getting because he's so new to the amateur scene, sort of. But I think Dahlke, I think USGA guy, US amateur runner-up, played so well at the Western, showed that his game might be back in the right direction. I think Dahlke might have a slight lead on that group.
Yeah, I think you can't overlook Will Zalatoris either. He's a former USGA champion, won the junior, and then also won last year's Transmiss. And in terms of if he could putt, I was told by a guy that's a potential Walker Cupper that Will Zalatoris might be one of the 10 best ball strikers in the world. Period.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the whole kind of Boston's whole decade thing kind of started with. He plays at the same club as Alex Forrest, and he said, "You hit it so good. If you just let me tell you where to hit it, you'll win." And Will did win. Mm-hmm. From everything I've heard, Will is like world class ball striking wise. It is the putter, unfortunately, that holds him back. And so I think that assessment definitely is true.
I definitely think I agree with you on the John Oda thing. I think he might be the most overlooked and underrated guy in all of amateur golf. He also qualified for the U.S. Open. He was nothing but Mr. Consistent at UNLV. But he always seems to get overlooked, probably because he's there's that West Coast bias. He's out in Hawaii. So I think it'll be really interesting to see. And I agree that this USAM is going to be a big definer of kind of who gets in, and I'll put together a little bit more color on this in an article, but it's a crazy situation for Spider Miller and who he's going to have to pick from, because you can make a case for all of these guys.
Yeah, Oda was a first team All-American. I mean, that's one of the top eight guys in college golf, basically. I think Sahith won the Holly Players. He qualified for the U.S. Open as well. I would love to see Dawson make it, just someone different, you know, a different kind of tool than our usual powerhouses. But I think it's almost so tight this year that there really might not be any controversy because there's just more guys than our spots, unfortunately. It's not very clear cut. I mean, I think there's 5 to 7 clear cut guys, but then there's like 10 guys who are deserving of those last 2 or 3 spots.
And I think there's another little underlying factor is like guys like John Oda and Sean Crocker, these guys have delayed turning professional for this. I mean, they're both planning to go pro after the Walker Cup. Is like, does that weigh in that these guys have made a personal sacrifice to, you know, try and make this team?
Yeah, I think there's a point Ryan Ladner made in an article when this whole announcement schedule was released, but they weren't going to announce the team until after the U.S. Amateurs. That, you know, and it's hard. You can't just tell guys, oh, you're on the team, because they might, you know, who knows what might happen. They might get injured, they might start playing bad. But it is hard. I mean, these are people's livelihoods, in a sense. You know, this is a summer of professional golf they could be playing. I don't know. It's not an enviable position in a sense. Sam Burns is the same. I mean, Sam Burns put that note on Twitter that he was turning pro after the Walker Cup because he wanted to try to play to represent his country. I think, though, as tight as things are, I don't think you can give people, you know, a nod in that direction just for that reason. But it is curious to see if they keep doing this, so they don't announce the team until August, if more guys start to turn pro you know, in June and don't try to make the team. We always had a couple each year to try to do it, but I think, too, the Walker Cup has risen to such stature. So many guys were stars on tour now speak so highly of it, from Jordan Spieth and Ricky Fowler and Justin Thomas, that I think it's such a goal that I think guys are willing to make that sacrifice.
I'd also be interested from the economic sense of what happens to your sponsorship deal if you play in a Walker Cup. You know, how much is that worth? And your initial deal, is it $100,000 honor, or is it, you know, 50, or does it really not matter from an agent standpoint?
I think, like I said, I think we rate amateurs so much by their accomplishments that we can kind of put on their resume and how good the resume looks, which I think sometimes we can overrate guys who have pretty resumes, and we can underrate guys who don't have the big win but are very skilled players. I think kind of like we talked about with Nick Hardy, that it's all about the resume when you turn pro. So to put Walker Cup on there and to say that you did something that guys like Jordan Spieth and Justin Thomas have done, I think it's worth a lot of money. I think I wouldn't be surprised if kind of the estimate that you gave is not that far off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's got to be really big for sponsors exemptions too, and getting those 7 full starts and that full opportunity. Because, I mean, a perfect example is a guy like Charlie Danielson, 4-time All-American at Illinois, but, you know, no huge win, no huge honor, and he hasn't gotten, you know, as many sponsors exemptions as a guy like Bo Hostler got, who was a, you know, Haskins Award winner, Hogan, he didn't win the Hogan Award, but Haskins Award winner, you know, clear-cut Walker Cupper, you know, had all this success from a young age with the U.S. Open at age 17. So, I mean, this is a big deal, is getting onto this Walker Cup team.
Definitely. And, I mean, it's the power of television. I mean, Bo Hostler, you know, most people, when they see Bo Hostler's name, they think U.S. Open Olympic Club. And so that's because he's on television. So I think anything you can do that gets you on TV helps so much when you turn pro, because sponsors want attention for the tournament, and so some amateur star who contended at a tour event that people got to know, it's such a big deal when you look for sponsor exemptions and when you're making a name as an amateur.
So with the success of the NCAAs, do you foresee a world where, and especially as television coverage gets easier with like that new technology, I was thinking about it at the Western Am, like eventually you're going to be able to televise stuff with drones and stuff like that. Do you foresee, you know, more amateur golf being on TV?
I think so. I don't know what the hang up has been, to be honest, because like you said, it's much cheaper to do it now. I think part of it is, I think with Golf Channel, there's so many tours that they televise that there's not that much room, especially during the summer. It would be interesting. I don't know. You know, NCAA does so well rating-wise because there's so much on the line. I don't know how well your run-of-the-mill college event would do. I don't know how well your, you know, even Southern Highlands is such a great event, but there's not that passion. You're not playing for the national championships. So I don't know that college golf outside of the NCAA would do very well rating-wise. I do wonder, you know, if you could maybe somehow do it online and do it through, you know, the way we do like PGA Tour Live, that kind of stuff. It's just hard, I think, when you're, you know, the U.S. Amateur and the NCAAs are good viewing because, again, there's just so much on the line that you might not have at your other amateur events.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, the Western Am would be a cool one to eventually get on television. But yeah, I agree with that. It's tough, and it's such a small niche audience. There's a lot of passionate fans and a lot of people that care, but at the end of the day, it's not. But it, I mean, likewise, you go back to it, and it's you start to know who these future stars of the tour are.
Totally. I mean, I think it's all, when a guy turns pro, it's all about whether or not he's on TV, I think, as far as the general fan knows him. I mean, same with Spieth, when he turned pro. I mean, obviously, he was very good. The people knew him from the Byron Nelson season he ended in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree. Hey, you want to get out of here on some overrated, underrated?
I don't think I can leave without doing it.
I got some good ones for you. Let's go with the Western Am.
I'm going to say underrated only because I think, I mean, it's turning to the prop amateur-wise, and I think most amateur golf is underrated, so I got to go underrated.
Yeah, it's the best field. I like it. I think it's the Masters of amateur golf. So
yeah, I'm glad the U.S. Amateur. I'm glad that they put in the top 50 world ranking exemption. Mm-hmm. But still, so much of that field is qualifiers that you get some names who miss out because they didn't qualify. Think of an NCAA's even. I think NCAA's needs to go to its own stroke play individual championship because you have guys who don't get to go because their team, you know, you get the number five guy from some random school who his teammate threw, so he plays in the NCAA championship, but then the number one player from a smaller school doesn't make the regional chief out there.
Perfect example is Colin Morikawa didn't make it to the NCAAs this year, and that's the number one player in the world, and that's a huge problem for the NCAAs. I completely agree. I think they need to create a separate individual championship where you take, say, the top 100 players from the Sagarin ranking, and then you have a couple individual qualifiers, and then you need to have, you know, the team championship, and maybe it's doing it opposite the women. So when the women's are doing their team championship, it's the men's individual. When the men's team championship's happening, it's the women's individual.
Totally.
So I agree with that. Let's do Riviera, overrated, underrated.
Ooh. Man, that one, I feel like it's very well rated, but I obviously can't give it
you can't
give
cop
it that.
Out.
I'm gonna go, I know, that's a cop out. I can't do it. I'm gonna go underrated. I think most things on the West Coast are, and I thought West Coast bias or East Coast bias is a total, you know, excuse until I lived on the East Coast, and then I realized sporting events start so late here, everything else, that really East Coast bias is definitely a thing. So almost everything on the West Coast is underrated.
Yeah, I look at Riviera and I see how it could be so much better. I don't think they got the best renovation done by Tom Fazio, and if you got that thing you know, a little bit more width in the fairways and brought back, I mean, like, the 10th hole kind of got changed. It's obviously one of the most iconic holes in golf, but I think it could be even better if they fix the green. Next one.
I got to go back to the 10th hole real quick. This is an unpopular take on the 10th hole, but I think they've got to shave down so much of that rough on the left side. Because if you look, the ideal angle where you're shooting right up the green to have the whole green to work with is in the left rough, basically. And I feel like that needs to be fairway to allow you to try to play the proper angle where you're hitting up the green.
You know what I love about that, too, is it's such a... That strategy and is like counterintuitive, and that's what makes golf so great. Is like that strategy is hitting it 40 yards left of the green, when all you want to do, like everything about golf, is hitting it at a target, and having your target shift to 40 yards left is such a, it's such a cool little unique quirk. I love holes where, you know, you look at it and it, you know, you've got this wide fairway, say it's 80 yard wide fairway, but the depending on the pin, the strategy is to hit it down the very right edge of the fairway or the very left edge of the fairway, where, you know, that's what we were talking about with strategy and kind of how that could be the next smart thing.
One of the cool things of Spieth's strategy from Royal Birkdale that he kind of talked about at the Bridgestone was that the rough, as most people know, is pretty low at Birkdale. It's pretty playable. And obviously the pop bunkers are pretty penal. It's basically a one-stroke penalty. So he was talking about the tee shot on 13 where he blew it way right, and everyone said it was 100 yards from the center of the fairway. He's like, yeah, but it was like 30 yards from right of my target, because his target was the right rough, because the rough's very playable. It gave you a good angle from over there. And the pop bunker to the left side of the fairway was so penal that he was blasting it into basically the light rough on the right side.
It's interesting because you look at his driving stats from the week and he hit so few fairways, but then so many greens, and it's all angles.
It's total. I mean, his fairway on a lot of holes was the rough, because the rough was so playable and pop bunkers are so penal that he just said, all right, let's just hit it in the rough, because the penalty for the rough is basically non-existent. That's why it was definitely very deceptive. If you looked at his driving stats, you would have thought he drove it horribly, when in reality, it was really just great strategy.
It's interesting. I mean, that is such a Tiger thing to do, where Tiger knew everywhere to miss and just, you know, a lot of times was aiming down rough lines, just because he knew from there he was, you know, it's similar to Jordan, where Jordan's, his approach shots have become such a weapon. You know, Tiger was so good with his irons that, and he was so strong out of the rough that it didn't really matter.
Yeah, I mean, it's getting talked about more, but I mean, Jordan's literally number one on tour in stroke gained approach to green. And we saw him make all those big putts at the end of the Open, but his putting is not where it was a couple years ago. And so it's almost like if you combine the way he's hitting it this year with his best putting, I mean, it could be, you know, you don't want to make predictions. Golf's hard, and it's kind of like whack-a-mole, where one thing gets good and then another part of your game struggles. But if he can combine those somehow, I mean, it's a really strong play that he could start producing, which he has already.
It's he's a transcendent talent. I mean,
yeah,
it's he does it in a completely different way than Tiger does it, and it's not as glamorous or pretty. And sure, watching Rory hit 350-yard bombs off the tee is really entertaining, and Jordan's never going to be somebody that's like, wow, that was a really pretty 65. But, you know, it's pretty in its own way.
Yeah, I think, I think we underrate Spieth as a ball striker because of his reactions after the shot. Like, you know, he's talking to it, and he's yelling at his ball and that kind of stuff, but you know, on TV, you don't see the ball flight. You see the player swing, the follow through, the reaction, and you see it land. And so when you're basing it based on all their reaction, then you think Spieth's hitting it bad. In reality, it's just he has very high expectations for himself, and the end result where it's ending up is actually very good. So I think that's one reason why, and also because it's not as elegant as Rory, that we underrate him as a ball striker.
I also, it's interesting, because I think that's an example of where Spieth's flaws with his driver, where he doesn't have this. I think, you know, Rory doesn't ever look at a hole and think, I can't hit this shot with a driver, where Spieth looks at a hole and says, wow, I can't miss that left. And so he aims in the right rough. And it's where a flaw turns into a strength.
Mm-hmm.
Where Rory might end up in that left bunker because he has a supreme confidence in his driver.
What is it? I think it's like a McKenzie line about how you keep egging people into basically taking on more and more and more. Mm-hmm. And then they kind of finally they get bitten, and so they kind of back off, and then they keep taking on more and more and more until they get bit again. It's kind of like that.
Yeah, it's interesting. The psychology of design is a underrated aspect of architecture, I think. Next topic, Quail Hollow.
Ooh, I'm going to go overrated. I think that early returns, especially from the players, is that I don't think they're hugely in favor of what was done here. And I think, you know, you had a golf course, obviously it gave us some low scores, but you had a golf course that I think people liked. It was, and now it's just hard. Whereas it had some character before, and yeah, it was very scoreable, but it had a lot of character, and now it's just hard. And so I think that the early returns from players are that it's not, they don't love it as much as they loved it pre-renovation. And I think just, again, because I mean, you have three par fours over 500 yards, it's just hard now.
Yeah, I was talking to Paulie, my picks guy, last night, and he brought up a great point, is the guys that start on the back nine and have to do the green mile to end, and then it rolls right in one through four, which is now really very, very difficult. Like, that 6 and 7 hole stretch there is all of a sudden, you know, and 6 or 7, like, extremely difficult holes in a row is so hard to play. Yeah. As a player, I mean, yeah. you need almost a break at some point. So it'll be interesting to see if we see any discrepancy in the guys that have to tee off on the back nine first, or, you know, it just when, like, scoring average, just from the psychology of it, of back nine starts versus front nine starts. Obviously, everybody gets one of each, but it'll be interesting to see if you can pull any statistical differences in that.
That's true. That's a really good point from Paulie. I have a friend who's deep in Paulie. He thinks he's a genius. But that's a brutal 7-hole stretch to have to play them consecutively.
Yeah, Paulie's very, very smart. He's a really good player, which I think helps when you're extremely good with numbers and a good golfer. I think he pulls a little bit more than a lot of other guys do.
Yeah.
So last one. The career Grand Slam, underrated, overrated?
Ooh, I'm going to go underrated. I think it's so hard. I mean, not only have you to do it, it's four different types of tournaments, obviously. The U.S. Open, you know, it has different identities, but usually it's a U.S. Open and thick, rough, narrow fairways, that kind of stuff. But it's winning on so many different types of tournaments, and there's only four majors a year. And I think really once you've got three legs, I think it's so hard. I think Rory's already starting to feel it of every time he goes to Augusta, and Augusta's different. You have to wait 8 months, but every time he goes to Augusta, it's all that pressure on him. And, you know, I think I saw somewhere that all the guys who completed it, they completed it within like three tries. Mm-hmm. And you look at like Tom Watson and Arnold Palmer, for the two of them, it was the PGA that kept them from doing it. I mean, so you have great players who have won three legs. Winning all four, I think, is really hard, because once you have three of them down, it gets so the pressure gets so high.
Yeah, but yeah.
I think
it's interesting.
It's an amazing stat.
I had a sports psychologist on, and he talked about how a lot of times great play comes from low expectations, and when you don't. You know, the idea of trying to treat every tournament the same, and it almost becomes impossible when you're going for the career Grand Slam.
Yeah, and I think, too, another good point is really the Grand Slam didn't become a thing until really Arnold Palmer, kind of 1960, he won the Masters and the U.S. Open, and then was going over to St. Andrews. And that's really when the Grand Slam hype kind of started. You had Bobby Jones' version, but the four professional majors. And so, you know, you look at Sarazen and Hogan, the Grand Slam wasn't really as much of a thing when they did it. Hogan, I mean, did it after the bus crash. That makes it amazing in itself. But really, so you only had three guys, I think, you know, Player, Nicklaus, and Tiger, who did it after the Grand Slam really became a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I mean, the three guys in the last 50-something years. So that shows how hard it is.
You know, I forgot who tweeted it last night. Somebody tweeted that the Tiger Slam is being diminished. Oh, is Brian Atkinson, the Tiger Slam is being diminished because of the PGA move.
Well, you know what's crazy, and I'm not trying to sell the Players as a fifth major, but in the midst of the Tiger Slam, Tiger also won the Players. So he won the five biggest titles that you can win in golf in a row. Because back then, the Players was in March. So mm-hmm. he won the Players before he won the Masters to cap off the Tiger Slam. And so I think that makes it even that much more nuts.
Yeah, it's crazy. That is actually something that's never been talked about. But because the Sawgrass was like arguably one of the worst setups for Tiger.
Yeah, it's distance is not an advantage. It's placing your ball. It's strategy. It's, you know, a lot of discipline to hit lesser clubs off the tee. You don't overpower that golf course. And you kind of massage your way around it.
Yeah, and not getting over aggressive on approach shots either. So I can't leave you without asking. I we're running long here, but what about Hideki?
Overrated, underrated?
No, just Hideki. What is he the most underrated? Him in the Japanese media, the most underrated story in sports or in golf?
At least in golf. I mean, Hideki is number 3 in the world in leading the FedEx Cup, and he doesn't even come into the media center at the PGA for a pre-round interview. Now, granted, obviously, a lot of that's the language barrier, but still, I mean, at least I credit Augusta. Augusta brings him in, and I think he did a pretty good interview at Augusta. I remember I asked him, like, are you ever happy with your ball striking? And he basically said no, because he's talking about how bad he was hitting, and of course, he finished like 11th that week.
Yeah.
Top 15 in all three majors. The 61 was the best final round from a strokes gained perspective this year. I mean, 3 wins this year, I think hardcore underrated. Probably the most of all the things we talked about today, most underrated of all of them. And I get it. The language barrier makes it hard to cover and it makes it hard for fans to get to know him. But, I mean, it's pretty crazy what he did last week and what he's done in the majors. And I think he's about ready to conquer the world.
Yeah, I think if he wins that, he's also a big aspect of growing the game abroad. I hate the term
totally.
Growing the game, but he is I think he needs to win a major, and you'll see. But it's has the question, how many times has the question been asked? Can Hideki win?
I think 2 WGCs, and I think both of them were by 5 shots. I think that's worth 1 major, so I think he can win a major.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
I'm going to say affirmative yes.
61 final round, and then he says he didn't trust his swing is just out of control.
Well, Dottie Pepper said that his final round, like his warm up for the final round, was atrocious. Which I think it often is. I think he's like a lot of players, though. I think that once the gun sounds, he gets ready to go, and he's a gamer. I think he's very talented in the sense that I don't think he swings how he wants to very often, but he just saves shots through impact. And just, you know, it feels weird through impact. That's why he one-hands it and he doesn't like it, whatever, but then it ends up okay. I think he's got that innate kind of club face awareness that Phil has talked about, that he can just save shots and end up with good shots even on swings that he's not happy with.
Well, I mean, there's the old adage that, like, the best player is the player who misses the best, because, like, Hogan used to say,
yep.
He only hit 4 perfect shots per round.
Yeah.
And it's like Hideki gets penalized because he outwardly reacts to his poor shots, and it bugs
it's like
people.
Feet. Yeah,
but yeah, yeah. Exactly. And it's just like, well, like, he's just being honest, because like the reality is you only probably hit 5 or 6 perfect shots in a round of golf.
Yeah.
So it's he just misses really well. So I mean that's a big thing, and it's always just if he putts really well, he's gonna win.
Totally. Oh yeah. I mean that's what. He went on that tear. What was it, like 7 events this fall, I think, that he finished first or second in all of them. I think like 5 wins and 2 seconds or something. And it was because he was putting well.
Mm-hmm.
He's got to learn how to get back to that. I'm not sure if he will, but.
Putting doesn't matter.
He didn't need to carry that international team on his back.
Yeah, President's Cup.
So, I think were we talking about this? I think everyone hits it great. As you said, putting is a differentiator. So you have to hit the ball at a certain level to make it to the PGA Tour and to be elite on the PGA Tour. But then you need to putt well to separate yourself.
Yeah.
Like you're not going to be top 10 in the world hitting it bad.
This is my point is that everybody likes to look at a singular event in terms of like, oh, look, Jason Duffner just won with negative strokes gained putting. Like, if putting doesn't matter, you know, they do this. But if you look at careers as a whole, show me one person that you feel like has overachieved that was a really bad putter.
Right.
Everybody, you say, oh, like that guy, why doesn't that guy win more? And if you, almost every time you look at that player and you say, well, it's because they don't putt well.
I think great ball strikers, I mean, are going to be more consistent because they're going to give themselves more birdie opportunities. I mean, there's a lot more birdie pins for Rory than any other player out there. And so the weeks that he does putt well, he can win by a ton. And the weeks he putts badly, he finishes 10th. Mm-hmm. But that's because, I mean, he just has so many more birdie opportunities than everyone else. And so I think that's the biggest thing. A hot putter, they can win every once in a while, but week-to-week consistency and especially greatness where you win a bunch, I mean, that's built on very strong ball striking.
I mean, like Aaron Badley's won 5 times.
Yeah.
He's won more times than Gary Woodland.
True. But I think, yeah. Well, and you have to have a complete game, obviously. But I think great players, 5-plus majors, I would be hard-pressed to find a non-world-class ball striker in the group of guys who won 5 or more majors.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I mean, it's ball striking gets you to into contention, and putting wins you the tournament.
Yeah, I think Jake Nicklaus tweeted something like, would you rather have Rory's driving or Spieth's putting? And he said, like, what? How you answer will determine or will show how much you know about the game. Because really, for most people, they could probably benefit most from Rory's driving, I think.
If you put people where Rory hits his drives, like your ceiling is so high, or your floor is so high, like you can't really play bad from 130 yards out in the middle of the fairway.
Right. Actually, I think Sean Foley put it best. I use this one a lot. He said, like, all right, let's take my dad and Hunter Mahan, or any player, Justin Rose, and let's do a chipping contest. Drop 5 balls. You know, my dad might win every once in a while and, like, chip 3 of them closer than Justin Rose does. But if we do close to the pin from 200 yards, like, my dad's not even come within 50 yards of Justin Rose. And just showing that the biggest separation between players happens at the greatest distances.
Yeah, I agree. Every level, I think, like every level, the biggest difference when you move up is play from like 150 yards to 50 yards is the biggest. It, actually, like 150 and in really is when you look at the difference between a really good amateur and a great amateur, or a great amateur and a great pro. I think you hear it so much with these guys when they turn pro is, what do you have to improve? Oh, it's my wedge play. Like, I got out here and realized, like, these guys are so good with wedges.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, I don't want to take up more of your time. Now we're at, like, almost an hour and 20. But it was. It's always good catching up. Always good conversation. Be sure to follow Sean on Twitter. It's what? At S Martin PGA Tour.
PGA Tour S Martin.
PGA Tour S Martin. You got any?
I feel like I should give a prize. Whoever makes it to the end of this podcast.
You know, there's a lot of people that get to the end of this. They got to hear the overrated, underrated.
That's true. This one's very long, though. I'm looking at my phone right now.
Yeah, it's all right. You know, if people don't want to listen, they'll just stop listening. So,
1.5 speed is the key on podcasts too.
Yeah, I've never gone into the 1.5 speed. You rave about it.
It'll change your life.
All right,
it'll change your life.
Tip, you got any articles coming out this week? What are you writing about?
I wrote one. I talked to Brian Harmon, actually, at Akron, and it was actually a really good interview, I thought. You know, Brian Harmon was like the team phenom before we had social media. Like, he made a tour cut at 17. He was the number one amateur in the world before he started college. Youngest guy to play in the Walker Cup. And he's 30 now, obviously. He has 2 tour wins, run up the U.S. Open, and kind of talked about how, you know, there's always that, oh, he's a little guy, a chip on his shoulder, and, you know, which there's truth to that. He always plays well after he gets motivated. But talked about, he's like, man, I turned 30 this year, and I was basically like, not that the end is near, but like, I gotta start doing what I thought I would always do. And it was just interesting hearing a guy who once was this phenom, the kind of guys we rave about now, when we talk about Walker Cup and such, who hasn't done what he thought he could, and kind of how realizing his own maybe mortality and golf mortality has really kind of inspired the best play of the season. I thought it was very honest and open for a tour player. And I'm writing Rory today, but everyone's writing Rory today. So
hey, I'll put the Brian Harman link in the pod description on the site.
Perfect.
So, but that's, I mean, I was the same age as Brian Harman, and he was unbelievable as a junior. He won everything.
Yeah.
He was the clear-cut best player in the world at like age 17 as an amateur.
He was talking about if there had been Twitter when he was in high school, he probably would have just turned pro at high school, because he would have been blown up so much on social media that might as well.
Yeah, it's crazy. He was so good. So, all right. Well, Sean, thanks, and we'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, man.
All right. Later.
Later.